96-2529, Stanley Miller versus Walmart. Representing Walmart is Joseph Roby, who will introduce Jerome Ferrinet. Pronasek, I probably didn't pronounce your names right, but you can correct me.
May it please the court, my name is Joseph Roby. I'm a shareholder and director of Johnson, Kilner, Thibodeau, and Seiler in Duluth. I was admitted to practice in the State Bar of Wisconsin in February of 1985, and our office represents the appellant Walmart stores. Although I did not attend the trial, I did participate in the drafting of appellant's brief. Mr. Thomas Thibodeau and Mr. Jerome Ferrianchak of our office tried the case in Douglas County Circuit Court, with Mr. Ferrianchak conducting most of our direct and cross-examinations. Mr. Ferrianchak is with us today to present appellant's oral argument. By order dated October 6th of 97, this court admitted Mr. Ferrianchak pro hac vici to appear on behalf of appellant today. Fortunately, he came down with the flu overnight. But in a brave display of dutiful client representation, he wishes to proceed.
And give us all the flu.
we'll wait on this decision.
Don't breathe into the microphone.
Don't do us any favors.
Mr. Ferrianchak, we're happy you could come. This had been postponed for a couple of months, and we insisted it be put on the calendar. We did not know of your flu. We also understand from the marshal that if you make a sudden departure from the courtroom, it's not because we've offended you, or even if we have offended you, that's not the reason. You will be excused whether you depart during your argument. If you depart during your argument, we will not proceed without you. If you depart during opposing counsel's argument, we may take a brief recess. We may ask him to speak slowly. We'll see how we proceed, okay?
Okay.
We'll do the best we can.
Thank you.
All right. Be well.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is J.D. Ferrianchak, and we represent Walmart in this appeal, as Mr. Roby indicated. Walmart is before this court on three issues. First, the tort of negligent supervision should not be recognized, but if it is, this case does not satisfy the elements of causation. Second, Walmart should have been found immune from this action as a matter of law pursuant to Wisconsin Statute 943.50. And finally, the facts of this case do not justify the imposition of punitive damages. Relying on these three issues, Walmart asked the court to reverse the trial court's case in its entirety. Recognizing this court's decision in Cloudera, Walmart still asked the court to consider the burdens imposed upon state employers and reject the tort of negligent supervision in any form. The burden is too great because it creates liability for any wrongful conduct of an employee, even if the action of the employee was outside the scope of employment. If this tort is recognized, this court and trial courts in the future will have no way to limit the claims made against employers throughout this state. The employer will become an insurer for the employee's conduct. If this court does choose to recognize the tort, the claim is still subject to approximate cause analysis, and this may be one method of limiting the potential claims. Imposing a strict causation analysis is one way in which the endless bounds of this tort could be controlled. Negligent supervision is premised upon the wrongful conduct of an employer, but where an employee has not committed any wrong, the conduct of the employer cannot be considered because the tort is incomplete. The same is true in this particular case, because the jury determined that the Walmart employees failed to commit a battery, false imprisonment, or negligent infliction of emotional distress.
Counsel, you say failed to commit a wrong. By the word wrong, do you mean a recognized tort?
In the context in which this case was presented, they failed to commit any wrong or recognize tort.
Well, they did commit a wrong in the sense that they did act without probable cause.
That brings me to my second issue with respect to probable cause. We contend that there was probable cause.
Well, let's stay with your first issue. There was no tort here of false imprisonment, battery, etc., right?
Correct.
Okay. So, in this sense, there was no tort.
Correct. There was no...
What's the difference between a wrong and a tort?
The difference would be the injury which flows from the action. There was no injury or damage that flew from the action of the employees in this situation. Because when they stopped them, based upon what the jury determined was a lack of probable cause, you would still have had to have found false imprisonment, like the Radloff case said what would happen if there was a wrongful stop, a battery if there was an offensive touch, or a negligent infliction of emotional distress if there was some other conduct that was found to be caused injury to this particular plaintiff. That did not occur in this case, so the tort would not be complete.
You need a completed tort. That's
correct.
Your position.
In fact, the Midwest Knitting decision, the case relied upon heavily by respondents in this case, required an injury caused by an employee or servant. And as the comments to the restatement of agencies, Section 213 states, simply because an employer hires an incompetent, vicious, or careless person, that fact does not create liability. Only if the employee causes harm can the employer be found liable, because liability exists only if all the elements for a tort are present. In fact, every illustration within the restatement of agency, every case cited by the respondent, and every case cited by Walmart contains an example where the employee perpetrated a tort which caused injury. In other words, there must be a connection between respondent's injuries and the Walmart employee's conduct. The conduct must cause harm before any liability can be imposed. Now, although there are no Wisconsin cases directly on point, the Bankert decision and those cases which follow confirm the analysis within the context of a parent-child relationship and the interpretation of an insurance contract. In Bankert, there was no liability for the negligence of the parent because the child did not commit a wrongful act which was covered under the terms of the insurance contract. Since there was no underlying tort coverage, there was no negligent supervision claim subject to coverage as well.
Counsel, let me interrupt. I'm having some difficulty totally understanding your argument. Looking at the jury verdict in this case, which I understand was unanimous, you had a situation where the jury found that there was not probable cause to stop the plaintiff. The jury found that the conduct of Walmart, whatever that specifically was, probably tied to probable cause again, was outrageous conduct and awarded punitive damages. Why do you feel that it has to be a tort, such as the three torts that were specifically inquired into by the court at the special verdict, rather than pure and simply a violation of retaining or restraining or stopping someone without probable cause? I could understand why the jury could decide that wasn't false imprisonment, but it was still a wrong and was outrageous conduct.
Yeah. If you look at the way this case resolved itself, the issue becomes whether or not there was probable cause, but you can't stop with that analysis. If you determine there's no probable cause and allow a tort to go forward, the claim, there will be no stopping point. There will be no basis upon which this court to control future lawsuits.
Well, why couldn't stopping someone without probable cause in and of itself be a wrong which would justify the other findings of the jury? Why does it have to be one of the three torts that the court inquired into?
In other words, it's a new tort or a different tort.
Sure.
The reason is it should not be a new tort, and the reason that it should not serve as basis for liability is if you have no probable cause, you still need a damage or an injury flowing from that fact.
Well, they said that what sum will fairly and reasonably compensate plaintiff Miller with respect to past mental pain and suffering, and their answer was $20,000. So they found that, I mean, I don't know what they found, but if you read the verdict, it says, did Walmart act without probable cause? Yes. Was there pain and suffering? And the answer is yes. and the amount is 20 grand. So that's the new, I say new in quotes, wrong.
I think that the lack of probable cause does not create a new tort. And Radloff, the decision issued by the Supreme Court, states that. They say if you don't have probable cause, you may be subject to a tort of false imprisonment. And the best way to explain that, at least from the case and where you've got to limit these extreme examples, is if an employer hires a person with several aggravated assaults, tells that person to beat every single customer who comes in the store and is suspected of shoplifting, leaves that person unsupervised, there is still no claim if no injury results. There is still no claim if nothing happens in those situations. But if the court allows the tort to exist as it is, no employer could hire a person with a criminal past, no matter what type of rehabilitation the person undergoes.
I hire somebody with a criminal past. They do everything right. No one is injured. I'm not liable for anything. They're not liable. I'm not liable. Right?
Right.
Okay. Now the person does something to matter, commits an assault on someone. So they're liable for the assault, right? And then the issue is the assault is outside the conduct, the course of the business, so I may not be liable under respondeat superior. That's what you're concerned about. Now, all of a sudden, I might be liable under negligent retention, hiring, retention, or supervising, because I knew the person had prior assaults. I may not have been careful in hiring and putting them in a position where they would lose their tempers or whatever. I mean, that's what you're posing, right?
Correct.
So what's the matter with that?
The problem is if you allow a tort to exist because of lack of probable cause, you do not have a complete tort as it relates to the individual employee and Walmart. There are certain aspects of it missing. If the missing points come from, if the stop was wrongful, was there causation for the torts that followed? The jury determined, and Respondent and Walmart are bound by the fact that there were no torts. If there was a lack of probable cause, something else should have occurred, either in the form of a false imprisonment because they wrongly held them, either in the form of a battery because they wrongly touched them, or in form of some negligent infliction of emotional distress because they held them in an open environment.
And the jury had instruction on all of those three torts, right?
Correct.
And they said no.
Correct.
Why can't you say that 943.50 sub 3 gives new, gives a person a cause of action?
Because the statute is an immunity statute.
I understand that.
And the cases, Radloff being the one, that talks about in terms of a wrongful stop leading to other torts, speaks only in terms of false imprisonment or secondary torts, battery, negligent infliction of emotional distress.
Is that after this statute was passed?
That was before. But there are no decisions in place in which a situation occurred where there was a wrongful stop based on what a jury found. And without any guidance to the contrary, Radloff is the only basis on which we've had to rely on.
Was a jury instructed in regard to the statute itself? And if so, how were they instructed on the statute?
The jury was instructed to the statute. If I recall, Your Honor, I believe the statute was submitted to them in blocks of the text of the statute were given to them. So they had, for the majority, a considerable part of the statute when they made their deliberations.
As part of the instructions as to question number one?
I'm sorry.
Were they given the statute as part of the instructions on question number one?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
What about on the damage issue on question number 11? What kind of instructions were they given?
The damage issue was completely separate. It was answer this question regardless of how you answer the other ones, and it was just a standard jury instruction with respect to damages.
On punitive damages also?
Pardon me?
On punitive damages?
Yes.
Yeah. So
yes.
It was just a standard. Okay.
Yeah. It was the standard question right from the Wisconsin jury instructions.
Counsel, one of the arguments you've just made, well, essentially, it's an argument that the sky is falling. There has to be an ending point, and if there isn't, then there are problems. And yet I see, you know, there's the restatement, I think, of towards an agency which adopted negligent supervision, and jurisdictions have adopted it, you know, and they're still alive and well and running states in this country. What kind of doom has befallen them because of adopting the restatements?
There's no doom befallen to any state who's accepted negligent supervision. The doom I envision in this situation is if the tort is allowed to go forward without any underlying tort committed by an employee.
Has any jurisdiction that has adopted a negligent supervision retention firing cause of action adopted it absent an underlying tort?
To my knowledge, no. To my knowledge, based upon looking at the restatement of agency, looking at every case cited by the respondent, looking at every case that I cited, you always had an underlying tort. Even with every single example within the comments to the restatement of agency, you have an underlying tort where the employee caused injury.
And the underlying tort, you mean a completed tort?
A completed
tort. Where there is negligence, causation, and injury brought about by the activities of the employee.
And the reason that becomes so important is because this negligent supervision tort creates liability for an employer beyond the scope of employment. And that's where the limitation has to come into play. If the employer is going to be bound for the negligent or wrongful acts of an employee outside the scope of employment, there has to be limitations. There just has to be.
Well, even if I buy that, which has an appeal, what was the argument here, and what was the opening and closing statements to the jury relating to the damages and the reasonable cause? I mean, there must be an argument here that would have persuaded the jury that there was damage simply by the unreasonable detention.
If I recall, Your Honor, there were no discussions in that framework. There were no discussions that if Walmart negligently supervised these particular people without an underlying tort, that they could still be held responsible. That wouldn't be in line with what the restatement of agencies provided, and that wouldn't be in line with the jury instruction given with respect to negligent supervision to these individuals. What it resulted in is a verdict that couldn't be interpreted correctly, because you had in three employee torts, the jury found no liability, and one tort directed to Walmart that required employee torts. The court should have, at the post-trial motion, read jury verdict and taken away the entire case based upon the jury's conclusions.
Is that what you asked for?
That is what we asked for.
Let me give you perhaps an extreme example. An employer hires someone with a mental disability who has the mental capacity under the age of 7. That person does a wrong which causes harm, or causes injury. Arguably, that person cannot be negligent under the law, cannot commit tort. Are you saying then that there would be no, if Wisconsin had a negligent supervision tort, that no cause of action could be maintained because the underlying employee did not commit a tort?
I think under those situations, you'd have to go to the parent-child cases that in Wisconsin, which do hold parents responsible for the negligent acts of their children. And in those situations, if you have a completed tort caused by this particular individual, even though that person couldn't be held responsible for the actions, you still have the completed tort, different than what you have in this situation, because that 7-year-old mentally incapacitated person did an action which caused the injury. That would be the difference, and that would why that case could go forward, and this case should not. I briefly want to move on to the issue of merchant immunity. And for the most part, it's adequately discussed in my brief, but there is one dispute which stems from the interpretation of probable cause. But before I get into that argument, if the facts in this particular case involving Walmart serves as a basis for eroding merchant immunity, the statute 943.50 is useless because the facts are exactly the same as the Johnson versus Kmart case, except in that case, there was a mistake in the identity of the product, but in this one, there was a mistake in that respondent didn't have the swimsuit after he left the store. Returning to the probable cause assessment, this assessment must be made from the Walmart employee's perspective at the time he made the stop. If there are sufficient facts to support a belief based upon a common sense assessment of probabilities, there is probable cause. Using the Walmart employee's, no one else's knowledge at the time he made the stop, he found the following. Respondent selected a swimsuit and placed it on his lap. Respondent left the swimsuit area of the store and went to the electronics department. While at the electronics department, he had purchased the swimsuit or purchased an electronic piece of equipment but didn't pay for the swimsuit. He left the electronics department, still had the swimsuit on his lap, went to an aisle, made a motion of concealment, turned around, didn't have the swimsuit on his lap.
Did the jury find, however, there was no probable cause or reasonable cause?
The jury did. What we're saying here today is, shouldn't even got that far. The judge should have taken a look at the facts from the perspective of Mr. Manis, the loss prevention person from Walmart, and said, you're right, there's probable cause here as a matter of law. All of the remaining eight factors in 943.50 as analyzed in Johnson were satisfied. This case should have never gotten that far.
Well, is the determination of probable cause under 943.50 to be determined by the judge or the jury when there is a jury?
In this situation, what we're asking this court to do is look at the case, the facts as they are set forth from Mr. Mann.
Well, are you asking us to take it away from the jury?
Correct.
Rather...
You think in this case that ordinarily the jury determines this, right?
The jury? I don't want to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Ordinarily, this is a jury question. But like all... Is that right?
No. In this situation, my opinion is this, that... And I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm sorry if I am. But in this situation, when you look at the facts from the perspective of Mr. Manis, and there are no disputes, then it's up to the judge to take care of it.
I'll then complete it. Ordinarily, a jury determines this issue. However, when the facts set forth can only give one response, then it's a directed verdict in effect on that issue, and it's taken away as a matter of law from the jury, and the judge decides it. And your position in this case is it falls into the, quote, directed verdict area.
Correct.
And even if the judge had given it to the jury, then the judge, after the jury verdict, should change the answer, because as a matter of law, your position is the answer has to be there was probable cause.
That is correct.
Even though the employee apparently had taken off his eyes off the plaintiff here for a while.
That is still correct, yes. Okay. Based upon the fact that he knew, that was still probable cause.
Counsel, given your position earlier in regard to the need for an underlying tort, is it your position that part of the problem here was the sequence of questions in the verdict? In other words, should the verdict form first have inquired in regard to the three torts and then ask the questions that would relate to immunity? That's the way you're arguing sequence-wise today. Was the verdict sequence wrong?
The sequence in terms of the special verdict form is not anything that I'm particularly concerned with, because the court, with its powers as to interpret the law that should be applied to this case, should have determined that the three underlying torts were not established. Therefore, you can't have a negligent supervision claim.
Well, isn't it logical to look first at whether or not taking your position again, to look first at whether or not there's an underlying tort that's been committed. If the jury says no, there's no underlying tort that's been committed here, then the immunity issue is out the window, is it not? Given your position.
Given my position, I think the immunity issue remains, if I understand your question correctly.
Why would there be any need for the jury to address immunity if, given your position, that you must have an underlying tort before there could be a claim for negligent supervision?
Immunity applies to the ability to stop an individual who is suspected of shoplifting.
No, it doesn't say that. It says any merchant's adult employee, or merchant's security agent who acts in good faith in any act authorized under this section is immune from civil or criminal liability for those acts. So what Justice Crooks is asking you is, if there's no liability, you don't have to ever get to immunity.
If there's no liability for the underlying torts,
what is he immune from? If there's no civil or criminal liability for the stop, then you don't have to ever get to immunity. So I understand Justice Crooks' comment to you. First you say, is there liability? If you say no, then you never have to find them immune. Instead of saying, is there immunity?
My time is over, and I'd like to respond to your answers. Is that okay?
Feel free, yes.
Okay.
So Justice Brooks' question.
With respect to...
With assistance.
I'll look at both. With respect to the immunity issue, plaintiffs submitted their case on a multitude of torts. The immunity was under 953.50 was a defense brought up by Walmart. That is why all of the questions were submitted. That is why the questions in their order don't matter, and that is why what the jury resolved wouldn't have had any effect on the outcome of the case, because the respondents in this situation would still have wanted all four of those questions: battery, false imprisonment, negligent infliction of emotional distress, and negligent supervision on the special verdict form.
If the jury had been asked to answer those three questions in regard to the three underlying torts first, and told only if they had answered yes to one of those three questions, would they then have to answer the immunity questions? Would that not have been more logical and made more sense, given your position that there has to be an underlying tort?
2020 hindsight, I can understand where that comes from, and it makes sense. The problem with that we have is, under the situation we're dealing with, you have three independent torts that the plaintiff is seeking compensation for over and above the particular individual's or particular company's responsibility. And in fact, in this case, the individuals were just dismissed from the suit just before the suit began. You still have the potential for responsibility for the false imprisonment, the battery, even if there's immunity. If we had probable cause to dispute or to stop this individual and there was immunity, then you'd have to look to the other eight factors. Was the detention reasonable? That's where these other factors would come into play in terms of false imprisonment, battery, and those things. That's why you needed to have the verdict form set up in the format that we did. We certainly could have done it this way, but again, you'd be limiting plaintiff's ability to bring a claim for false imprisonment, negligent infliction of emotional distress.
Thank you, counsel. You've endured the half hour quite well.
Thank you.
Mr. Kinnelly, representing Miller.
Actually, Your Honor, I have a real tough name to pronounce. It's Canuet.
Canuet, fine. How do you feel?
I feel real good.
Okay.
I'd like to thank the court for its indulgence when this case was originally set for oral argument, I was in the hospital having some unexpected back surgery, and then my appendix went. So I was in no position to come down, and the other lawyer was in trial, so we were in a tough position, and I appreciate your...
Sorry, no problem. I'm glad everybody arrived today.
The case was just too hard on us.
You guys might need some good lawyers.
The truth is, that's our MOA. How many shows?
Well, my name is Bob Canuet, and I represent the respondents, Stanley and Deborah Miller. And Walmart has brought three issues to the court's attention here, and I think it's more appropriate, really, to split that first issue into two issues. And the first issue would be whether this tort of negligent supervision, hiring, or training is recognized, and the second issue is this underlying tort issue. So that's the way I'm going to discuss it, unless the court has a difficulty with that. And first, with regard to the whether the tort is recognized in Wisconsin. Well, what are we really alleging here in alleging that this tort is recognized or should be recognized? It's negligent failure to supervise, hire, or train Walmart's loss prevention employees. And I think here the key that the court should really focus on, what the evidence in the case was that Walmart negligently failed to train its loss prevention employees. They failed to train them. They also failed to supervise them. There was some evidence on hiring, but there really wasn't much evidence in that regard. Now, assuming that this tort does exist, what would the elements of the tort be? Well, they'd be the normal Wisconsin negligence elements, and that would be duty. Was there a duty? Well, there's a duty when it would be foreseeable that an omission or an act may cause harm to someone. Well, I guess the big question is then, was it foreseeable to Walmart that if it failed to train its loss prevention employees, employees with significant powers to detain people, make accusations of them in public, if it failed to train those people, could anybody be harmed? Could someone be improperly stopped, improperly accused of theft, embarrassed, traumatized, humiliated in public? And I think it was foreseeable. I think it's very foreseeable, particularly in this context where Walmart is the sole controller of how these employees are trained.
Then it's your position that you don't need a liability by the employee. Ordinarily, an employee is liable for his own torts, right? You can sue the employee. You don't have to sue the employer. Or you can sue both the employer and the employee, right? Could you have sued this employee here?
We could have done that, Your Honor.
On what basis?
We could have sued the employee for, we couldn't have sued him directly in his own right.
Why not?
Well, because he was acting within the scope of his authority.
No, I mean, if I drive a car for the post office and I am negligent and hit somebody, ordinarily you'll sue the U.S. government because you're sure you're going to get paid, but I may be personally liable.
That's true.
And you could sue me.
Right.
Right.
And I think we could have sued the loss prevention employees in this case.
How could, on what basis? I mean, how could you have won? You can't. The jury said no false imprisonment. The jury said no negligent infliction of injury. The jury said no battery. How could you have won against the employee?
Well, we didn't know that until the jury came back with its verdict.
Okay, you could have sued, but you wouldn't have won in this case.
Well, we thought we were going to win, and that's why we presented the alternative theories, you know.
That's fine, and I mean, he could have sued him, but you wouldn't have won, so that you could not have gotten a verdict or a judgment against this employee, right?
Not with this jury, no.
That's right, okay.
Just as an aside, what training did this employee have from Walmart?
I wish we knew more about that, Your Honor. We inquired as
what isn't
training.
That an issue that whatever training he had, it was negligent?
Right. Well, the training that he received and the way the testimony came out was, and this is in the record, he was trained in the loss prevention, police officer training up at, I think it was Hibbing Community College up on the range in Minnesota. So he was trained as a police officer. I believe he was trained even to the extent that he could sit for the police officer examination.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd had that training. Walmart had a training manual that it provided to its loss prevention employees. That was never introduced in evidence for some reason. And then I believe the way the testimony came out was that this employee was trained by being thrown into a loss prevention situation with a supervisor over him and just kind of learning the ropes from that loss prevention supervisor. And in a lot of respects, when Walmart did that, they didn't even follow their own procedures in training this gentleman. One of the procedures was that this gentleman should have been given a copy of local shoplifting law, Wisconsin Statute 943.50. Wasn't given that by the guy who trained him in. Does that answer your question?
Didn't he think he had authority to make an arrest?
Yes, he did. He testified directly to that. He also testified that he had authority to interrogate people. He also testified that he had authority to search for merchandise without a police officer there. I mean, this gentleman, I think he thought he was a police officer. Now, assuming that there is a duty, the next element would be breach, and I think that's what we've just been talking about. Was this duty to train and supervise breach? And I think there's ample evidence that the duty was breached. Walmart didn't instruct this employee on Wisconsin law. As a result, he thought he could arrest, interrogate, search, things of that nature.
He thought he could search regardless of consent?
Yes.
As long as he had probable cause, he could do what a normal police officer could do.
I don't believe he even was concerned about probable cause. He talked about it in his testimony, but a little bit. But I think he thought that he could arrest people and commensurate with that arrest, search them.
Well, if he thought he had arrest, I mean, most people are trained that you can only arrest on probable cause.
That's correct. One other thing that came out in the testimony was that none of the Walmart employees was ever instructed on the special needs and abilities of disabled persons. And if the court recalls, our client in this case is wheelchair bound. The only way that he can carry merchandise once it's been purchased is to put it in his coat, his unbuttoned coat like that. He has no other way.
Well, he can put it on his lap. He put a swimming suit on his lap.
No, it's something like a swimming suit that can drape, he can put on his lap. But something hard like a bagged item, he can't put on his lap because the testimony was that as he motions with his wheelchair, it would fall off. That was his testimony. Also, he can't push a cart and wheel his wheelchair at the same time. So they weren't trained in that regard at all.
Didn't he have a sack in the back of his wheelchair that he could put things in?
He did, but he can't reach back there. That's a sack for someone else to use if they're pushing him. But he's really in a tough position in that regard. Now, I guess the third element would be causation. The failure to train these employees caused them to stop and search Mr. Miller when they had no right to do so. And then damages. How was Mr. Miller damaged? Well, there was testimony by psychologist Dr. Robert Pyle that this improper stop and this wrongful treatment or ill treatment that Mr. Miller was given by the Walmart employees caused him psychological damage. He was humiliated in a public parking lot in front of a Walmart store by these employees, and that caused him psychological damage. It also aggravated some chronic medical problems that he had. And there was testimony in that regard. So there was testimony to a reasonable medical certainty that this injury was both psychological and had physical manifestations for Mr. Miller. Now, and I think this is something the court covered with the appellant on his argument, but is this tort, having established the elements, is it recognized in Wisconsin? I think the court already pointed out the restatement of agency recognizes it already. Prosser and Keaton recognize it.
But do they recognize it in the absence of an underlying tort? The way I frame the issue, at least so far in this case, is in the absence of an underlying tort, is there a claim for negligent supervision in the state of Wisconsin? Another way of saying that is, even assuming there is a negligent supervision claim in Wisconsin, does it require the absence of an underlying tort?
Does it require the presence?
Yes. The presence of Lennox.
Right.
It's late. Underlying completed tort.
In other words, in the post office case, don't you have to have a good cause of action against the employee before you can hold the employer liable for negligent failure to hire, supervise, or train?
Yep.
No, I don't think you do, and here's why. All these cases that we've been talking about, these cases from the Seventh Circuit and from Illinois and from Minnesota, they all involve torts. That's great for those cases, but just because a tort happened in those cases or an assault or something of that nature doesn't necessarily mean that the conduct which gives rise to a negligent supervision claim has to rise to the level of a tort. It needs to be wrongful under Wisconsin law. I think that's what the...
Where's the stopping point then if you don't have an underlying tort? It's just whatever the jury thinks might have been wrongful conduct?
Well, the stopping point is the proximate cause inquiry that the court is ultimately going to make. I mean, let's say the jury goes ahead and finds causation. The court still always, in every case, though maybe not explicitly doing so, is supposed to make a specific proximate cause inquiry on public policy grounds as to whether liability should be imposed in this situation. That's Wisconsin's causation rule. First you have but-for causation, then you have proximate cause analysis.
I'm not quite sure if you're arguing for a new tort. Are you saying that the failure to adequately supervise or train is in of itself a tort, a wrong, and if it causes injury, it is compensable?
That's exactly what I'm arguing, Your Honor, and I think here's the key to that. The court has never explicitly said, look, here's negligent supervision, training, or hiring, and it's a tort, and here's the standard form jury instruction. It's not in the jury instruction guide. But what the court has done for the last 75 years is it has sustained causes of action in effect for negligent supervision, hiring, or training. And the Midwest Knitting Mills Court, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, went through and analyzed those cases, and it's in the Midwest Knitting Mills case, and it sets forth the three cases that it found in Wisconsin, and on the basis of the results in those cases, it opined that this court would recognize the tort of negligent supervision if the proper situation presented itself.
And in all those cases, was there an underlying tort by the employee?
In the first case, which is the architect case, I have the case right here. AE Investment Corporation versus Link Builders at 62 West 2nd, 479. In that case, an architect allegedly failed to supervise adequately the construction of a building because he didn't order some soil tests and the building then settled. There wasn't any underlying tort there. The plaintiff didn't sue the concrete manufacturer, the concrete installer, for not doing a soil test. They went right after the architect. The other case...
That's not merely failing to supervise the employee. That's actually getting the wrong equipment. That's a malpractice case.
No, it wasn't, Your Honor. It was actually it wasn't the architect's responsibility in that case to get the soil test. It was the architect's responsibility to supervise other subcontractors to get that soil test.
Okay. So the subcontractor committed malpractice. That was the underlying tort, and the architects are liable because they failed to supervise. That was their negligence.
We don't know if the subcontractor ever committed a tort because the plaintiff in that case never brought a cause of action against the subcontractor. They went right after the architect. And the court in that case went ahead and upheld that claim, okay, even without an underlying tort being on the record.
I'll reread A.
Okay.
It's a key tort case.
Okay. If you want me to continue on with those cases, the other case was the Lesh versus LNH Industries Limited at 161 West 2nd 887. In that case, a A railroad allegedly failed to supervise adequately a contractor hired to remove rails from a right-of-way, and in that case, I believe the subcontractor was brought into the case. Yes.
Counsel, this isn't... this is parallel to the underlying tort requirement. In your brief, you take issue with opposing counsel saying you shouldn't be able to plead in alternative theories. And you say at page 18 that the jury rejected other theories submitted does not and should not change this, being the liability of the employer. Then you go on. This is what I'm getting to. Appellant cannot cite any authority which imposes such a requirement, nor can appellant cite one negligent hiring, training, or supervision case from any jurisdiction which imposes such a requirement. What do you mean by that? Since when I asked your opposing counsel, do all of the other jurisdictions require underlying tort? And his response was in the affirmative. And here you're talking about other jurisdictions not imposing a requirement that there be shown, I guess, an underlying tort. And you're saying that he can't cite one negligent hiring, training, or supervision case from any jurisdiction which imposes such a requirement. So maybe I'm reading that wrong, but if not, clarify or explain what you mean by that.
Sure. What I was trying to say there, Your Honor, is all the cases that appellant cites, there were torts in the negligent supervision context. Lucky for the plaintiff in those cases that there was, but that doesn't mean that there needs to be a tort every time. Well, wrongful conduct is enough in Wisconsin.
Let me ask, do any cases from other jurisdictions have any cases from other jurisdictions address the issue of the need for underlying tort?
If there are any, I'm not aware of it.
What does the restatement of agency or Prosser and Keaton or any of the other secondary sources say about this issue of underlying tort?
The restatement of agency, section 213, just basically says what we've been saying, that an employer is responsible for the negligent supervision and I believe they say retention of its employees. It doesn't really go into whether there's an underlying tort. I think what appellant is doing is they're looking at all these cases, and there were underlying torts in those cases, and they're saying, look, all these other cases are underlying torts. Therefore, there should be an underlying tort in this case. And I don't think there's any requirement in Wisconsin law that be the case. Now, for some direction on that, look at that one Wisconsin case, and I think that's the Banker case. In Banker, they say there needs to be an underlying negligent act or a wrongful act.
Shouldn't there be some nexus between the negligent hiring, training, retaining, and actual harm done to somebody by that person, the negligently hired, trained, whatever? Shouldn't there be some nexus, and isn't that the underlying tort?
I agree, Your Honor, there needs to be a nexus, but the nexus is there without the underlying tort. Don't need two torts, we only need one. And the connection is Walmart didn't tell these employees what they were supposed to do. They didn't instruct them that they couldn't search this gentleman. They didn't instruct them that they couldn't interrogate him. They didn't instruct them that they had to have reasonable cause and what reasonable cause was. And therefore, these employees went ahead and stopped my client and injured him. That's the nexus. Don't need another tort to show that nexus, but I agree there does need to be a nexus.
Shouldn't their negligent, or shouldn't their training, retention, or whatever the other word is, have led to the injury itself? And you say that's a tort in itself that leads to the injury?
I believe that's what I'm saying, yes. I mean, that's the nexus. If they had trained these gentlemen properly, so that instead of going out there and haranguing my client in the parking lot in front of all these people, they just told him to come back into the store, we're going to call the police and straighten this matter out, my client wouldn't have any claim of injury at all. But what did they do? They did everything virtually that they're not supposed to do under WSSTAT 943-50, and as a result, my client was injured. Now, what did the jury do? Why did the jury reject these, you know, false imprisonment, battery, negligent infliction of emotional distress? Why did they reject those theories? Obviously, we'll never know, but here's what I think happened. I think the jury looked at Walmart's conduct and they said, listen, or look at Walmart. It would have been so easy for Walmart to instruct these gentlemen properly. They didn't do that. They recklessly failed to do that. How can we hold these gentlemen responsible for false imprisonment, battery, negligent infliction of emotional distress? It wasn't their fault. It's Walmart's fault. And how can we impose liability on Walmart here? How can we get the right party? Negligent training. That's what Walmart did. They negligently trained these gentlemen. And I think that's why they rejected those theories. Not because this conduct was in any sense innocent, but these loss prevention gentlemen just did not know what they were doing, and in the process they injured my client.
Mr. Canyon, if you were asked to capsulize for us what the wrongful conduct was, and you said there has to be wrongful conduct, how would you state that? How would you capsulize it?
Number one, the wrongful conduct was they stopped my client without reasonable cause. That's the first thing, and that's easy. Number two, after they had done that, they searched him without consent. They forced him to get up, and they searched underneath him. They patted his leg down. They searched in his jacket. They opened up his jacket, looked inside. They took his bag lunch and dropped it on the ground. All in front of at least 20 people, as my client testified to, out in this parking lot at Walmart, which is on a busy street in Superior. It's a pretty busy store. And in the process, they humiliated him. I mean, that was the wrongful conduct. And, you know, maybe to someone like yourself or I who wasn't wheelchair-bound, that maybe wouldn't even be a big deal. I think it would be a big deal to me personally. But
the jury, despite this evidence, said that despite the fact that he was touched, found no battery, that he was detained, the jury found no imprisonment, that he was lifted up and all of this occurred in front of 20 people, found no negligent emotional distress. What does that say about the jury verdict? Were they just disregarding his testimony?
I think this goes to what I said before, in that they wanted to impose liability on Walmart, not on these employees. And they don't realize that Walmart's going to be liable in any event. They look at these employees as maybe not intentionally doing this. Maybe that was the missing element, but that they were trained to do this. Walmart never disputed that. They were trained that they could arrest people. They were trained that they could search without consent.
I do note that all of these elements that were submitted are false imprisonment, battery, require intent. Negligence does not.
Was it intentional infliction of emotional distress or negligent?
Negligent. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That was submitted.
Yes.
And you didn't, on negligent infliction of emotional distress, wouldn't that have been covered by a respondeat superior?
Yes.
Was there any instruction on respondeat superior?
Yes.
So then your argument that the employees would be liable but not the employer doesn't make sense if the jury was really following the instructions, because they would have known that Walmart would be liable.
Well, but does the jury always really know what they're doing and what the effect of their verdict? You know,
I don't think that verdict was, at least if you're supporting that verdict, you better be careful.
Well, I think the jury's instructed on that. But even if they ultimately realize that Walmart's going to be responsible, I think the jury might have said, listen, these people weren't really culpable. We don't think this was the bad conduct. We don't think that they imprisoned this guy, that they battered him. But we do think that they searched him without consent, stopped him wrongfully, you know, things like that. And so I think that might be one explanation for the way the verdict came out. Once again, Your Honor, we did plead alternative theories. We didn't know which way this was going to come out.
No,
and we're entitled to do that, I think.
Right, and there's nothing the matter with that.
Yeah.
The problem is whether or not the jury verdict with all the alternatives available makes sense, and if it makes sense, whether it supports your theory.
Well, I think it does make sense because there's four elements under that claim, and they've all been satisfied: duty, breach, causation, and damages.
Well, let me throw out another theory for you to respond to. This may be totally off the wall. Maybe the underlying tort here that we create is the absence of probable cause. And stop.
That may very well be true. That may very well be true. And unfortunately, without a standard instruction on that, I don't think we felt comfortable. I mean, we almost felt that we were making new law the way it was, and we didn't want to really
that
make new law.
Additional, that would be two new torts. One,
that's right.
Well, this is real.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a question raised with your opposing counsel, that the underlying tort here, and I think Justice Crux raised it, the underlying tort here was stop and search without reasonable cause, which was the first jury verdict.
Your Honor's point is well taken, and I think the way we addressed that issue is we said, we didn't say this might be a tort, but I agree with Your Honor that it might. What we said was, even if it isn't, all that's required is wrongful conduct, and that wrongful stopping is wrongful conduct, and so that's the way we approached it. So we didn't think there needed to be a special instruction on that. Then I think we've covered the first two points there. I guess the next issue would be this reasonable cause issue. And we've been assuming that there was a reasonable cause and there wasn't, or assuming that there was a reasonable cause and there wasn't. And here's why. Walmart points to what its loss prevention employee knew at the time as establishing reasonable cause. And that is the standard. The standard is what would the totality of the circumstances within the detaining party's knowledge at the time of the stop lead a reasonable person to believe that the party detained had committed a crime? Now, this employee, Manis, was the only employee with any knowledge. What did he know? Well, Walmart relies on his testimony to establish this. Well, of course he's going to testify that to all kinds of facts that would establish probable cause, that he observed this motion of concealment and this and that. Well, the problem is his credibility was so damaged in front of the jury that the jury probably disregarded his testimony in its entirety. He testified at his deposition. There was never any purchase made. Then he's confronted at trial with the receipt and the bag and the check and everything. All of a sudden he changes his testimony. Oh, there was a purchase made. Well, I just didn't see it. Well, that's pretty hard to believe when his first claim is that he observed my client continuously throughout this whole situation. He didn't observe my client continuously. That's clear. That's clear from the evidence. And because he didn't observe my client continuously, he didn't observe a motion of concealment. He claims that my client made a motion of concealment in the young girl's department of Walmart. My client flat out denies that he ever made any sort of motion of concealment like that. And the jury, faced with those two conflicting versions of what happened, faced with these two conflicting versions of what Mr. Manis knew, resolved those facts in favor of my client. Now, Walmart might not like that, but those are the facts. And under the facts as testified to by my client, there's no way there was reasonable cause in this case. Walmart also argues that this case is analogous to the Johnson case. It's Johnson versus Kmart. The key fact in Johnson was that there was an informant within Kmart that actually thought she witnessed or actually saw the shopper physically take something. That informant was identified, produced, the shopper was able to confront that person, and the situation was resolved. Now we've got these two informants, and Walmart argues that this is analogous to our case. We've got informants in our case too. Big problem, never produced, never identified, never produced at trial, never testified. My client never given an opportunity to refute what these people said. And then what did they say? They said that my client was acting suspiciously. Is that reasonable cause? We would submit to the court that it's not reasonable cause under Wisconsin law. And then the third issue was whether the standard for punitive damages had been met, such that the jury should have been instructed on that. The standard for punitive damages at the time of this incident was obviously different than it is now. At that time, punitive damages were appropriate if there was conduct in reckless disregard. I'm out of time.
That's all right, counsel. Please finish.
If there was conduct in reckless disregard of the plaintiff's rights, such that the plaintiff was exposed to an unreasonable risk of harm. Now, punitive damages are appropriate where the conduct is egregious enough that it should be deterred in the future and punished now. What did Walmart do that constitutes recklessness? As I've said numerous times, they didn't instruct their loss prevention employees on Wisconsin law. These are people with power to go out and really do damage to innocent people in their stores. Instead, they instructed him their loss prevention personnel in direct contravention to Wisconsin law. They said, go ahead and search people without their consent. Go ahead and interrogate them, arrest them, recover merchandise from them. We know Wisconsin law says that you can't do that, but who's going to complain about it? Well, Stanley Miller complained about it. Now, Walmart doesn't like that. The jury agreed with Stanley Miller that that conduct was reckless, and they compensated him for that. This court should uphold the trial judge's decision to uphold that verdict.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ferriancheck?
Ferriancheck. Your Honors, I have no rebuttal at this time, and if there's any questions, otherwise I'm through. Thank you very much.
I have a question.
Okay.
Does the restatement of torts, the restatement of agency require an underlying tort?
The restatement of torts, the restatement of agency does state the following.
Clear, if you're going to read them.
It's in the comments, and it says, it's actually in the text itself, I believe. I think it's subsection B, which talks about causes harm.
Subsection B says, in the employment of
this is from memory here. I've got it in front of me now. It's actually in the first paragraph. A person conducting activity through servants or other agents is subject to liability for harm resulting from the conduct. And then if you go on to...
But are you saying that says you need to have an underlying tort?
No, that's the first basis. But if you go on and look through the particular comments, they talk about the dangerous quality created or dangerous tort created by the particular employee before harm can be imposed. And if you look at every single description within the particular...
I did, and that's why I asked the question. That is, I don't see in what I have, anyway, the comments A, B, C, and D to 213 agency, any statement that says you need an underlying tort. And I thought maybe I missed some.
Well, I think the strongest statement comes from, and I don't know if we've got the same page numbers, but I'll say it'd be the third paragraph under subdivision D, where it says, one who employs another to act for him is not liable under the rule stated in section 213 merely because the one employed is incompetent, vicious, or careless. And I think that sentence there certainly imposes something more than just negligent supervision.
I took the next sentence, though, to actually be supporting your opposing counsel's position. If liability results, it is because, under the circumstances, the employer has not taken the care which a prudent man would take in selecting the person for the business in hand. That sentence I take to support your opposing counsel's position that what you're really looking at is a tort of negligent training, that there's negligent training on behalf of the employer, that they breached the training. As a result of that breach of training, the harm was caused. So I'm missing it. Let me ask another question. In any of these other jurisdictions that have negligent supervision cases, do any specifically address the need for an underlying tort?
There is one case, and it comes